From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, in the era of peak TV and a handful of blockbusters dominating the box office, is there a future for movie theaters? Then, works by LGBTQ artists make their way out from behind bars to a museum show called On the Inside.
There's so much talent and emotion and power and strength that we don't have access to because, you know, so many people are incarcerated in this country.
And 50 years after Stonewall, we've got the story about the largely unknown music of the early gay liberation movement. All that coming up on The Frame. In 10 years, will we still go see movies in theaters? New York Times columnist Kyle Buchanan asked 24 prominent people in Hollywood to imagine the future of the multiplex. Among those he interviewed are studio heads, actors, writers, and filmmakers, including Ava DuVernay and the Avengers directors Anthony and Joe Russo.
You know, I think even the most casual movie lover is aware that things are changing, not just because we have Netflix sort of transforming the way that we watch these things, but there's a lot of other streaming services on the way. We have, you know, a movie industry that is dominated by superhero films, and increasingly smaller films are struggling to get noticed. And honestly, I think a lot of young would-be moviegoers are having their brains somewhat rewired by the model of binge watching, the model of watching things on YouTube or Instagram. So there's a whole lot of things happening all at once.
I want to ask you about the kinds of people you were looking for, because like a movie or a TV series, you kind of cast this with an interesting bunch of people. What were you looking for, and was there a common denominator?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Obviously, these are sort of discussions and topics that have been bubbling up, and people have kind of been talking around them or just talking to themselves. But I really noticed right after Green Book won Best Picture, Steven Spielberg made a comment about how he hoped that the Academy would recognize that Netflix movies should be eligible for the Emmy and not the Oscar. And that really set off a firestorm online, especially on social media, with people sort of decrying him as out of touch. So I thought, well, let me get a whole lot of these voices. Let me get people for whom, you know, the current blockbuster system is set up to work. And let me get people who are, you know, experimenting or trailblazers in the streaming arena. And what I found to be surprising is that almost all of the filmmakers I talked to, whether they are, you know, theatrical devotees or they're doing stuff for Netflix, you know, they're cognizant of how fast things are changing. The difference, though, is that the people who seem to be sort of a holdout, you know, obviously you can understand why, are studio heads. I talked to a lot of studio heads, and they said, you know, essentially everything is fine.
One of the things that I thought was really interesting is you talk to a lot of people who are typically not well represented in Hollywood, and that's women and people of color. John Chu, the director of Crazy Rich Asians, Lena Waithe, who is a writer-producer. She has an upcoming movie called Queen and Slim. Barry Jenkins, who directed Moonlight and If Beale Street Could Talk. And it felt like they see a real opportunity, that they have felt, and people like them have felt, that the barriers to entry were really high. And now, with so many streaming services and different outlets, that more voices are getting a chance to tell stories. Is that something you took away from your interviews?
Absolutely. On both sides of the equation, whether it's theatrical or streaming, you know, what was striking about doing this project is how I would say almost every single person out of the 24 I talked to mentioned Jordan Peele. And they use him as an avatar for different things. You know, the people who believe in the power left in the theatrical movie-going system would talk about how people do go to the theaters for Jordan Peele to see his original movies. But what a lot of people were talking about is that, you know, he signals sort of a renaissance for Black filmmakers, and that's really making studios wake up to the idea that this is an underserved audience and that there are underserved audiences, as Crazy Rich Asians proved last summer, and that maybe if you're looking for a way to get people to theaters to reawaken this movie habit or to awaken it at all in people who don't feel that, the way to do that is to let themselves see themselves on that very big screen.
We're talking with Kyle Buchanan from the New York Times about his piece, How Will the Movies as We Know Them Survive the Next 10 Years? I'm wondering, when you went into this story, you've been around this business good enough time. Mm-hmm. Did you have certain assumptions that were challenged? And did all of these interviews start to change your way of thinking about the business?
Somewhat. it made me a little more scared at the pace that this is all happening. I mean, it was evident to me that this was happening very fast. But yeah, you know, I mentioned Steven Spielberg and the whole Netflix Oscar debate earlier. And I think the reason it fascinated me is because I could kind of see both sides of that equation. You know, I mean, Spielberg is likening Netflix to, you know, a company like HBO, which their movies and they've had big stars in them, big directors make them. But those are Emmy eligible. He didn't understand why Netflix should be sort of eroding the sort of sacred idea of what a movie is, or a theatrical movie, at least, by contending for Oscars. And to some extent, I was like, he doesn't not have a point, especially because Netflix would often muddy the waters by taking these movies that they got Oscar eligibility for and then turning them around and trying to get them Emmy nominated too. But at the same time, the more I spoke to people like Ava DuVernay or Lena Waithe or, you know, people who'd been working in streaming, the idea that movie going is one of our most populist activities where everybody can race to the theater that's right by them and have these rosy memories. It's not quite the case for everybody in this country. You know, Ava likes to say that you can't watch Straight Outta Compton in Compton because there's no movie theater there. And she had a difficulty finding movie theaters like in Selma, for Selma. So this has not always been a habit that everyone could afford or, you know, could come by as easily as, you know, maybe people think. And when you put it that way and you think about the Netflix subscription costing, you know, as much a month as one movie ticket does, then you understand why it's more available to people. I also noticed when Bird Box was such a gigantic hit on Netflix, there were a lot of people who were being introduced to the male lead of that movie, Trevante Rhodes, for the very first time.
Even though he was in Moonlight.
Yeah, well, even though he was in Moonlight, which won Best Picture.
So from what you gathered, what is the value of keeping movie theaters around?
I mean, that's a tough question, right? To me, movie theaters at their best, it's this incredible communal experience that we're going to have less and less of as things become more online. There are so few places where you can go and sit amidst your neighbors or the other people in your city and feel like embiggened by an experience, an emotional experience that you're sharing with them. You might not be looking straight in their faces, but there is that sense that we get, you know, when you can tell how an audience is reacting, whether they're laughing, whether they're scared, or whether there's this little gasp at a twist. And when I think about the movies I love, that's often such an inextricable part of my memory, is remembering how other people saw it. And I just don't know that that's the same if we watch it on a TV set. And I think the distractions are way, way, way greater. A movie can't quite command our whole undivided attention if we're watching it on a television set as opposed to a theater.
Kyle Buchanan is the Carpetbagger columnist at the New York Times. He's the author of the article, How Will the Movies as We Know Them Survive the Next 10 Years? Kyle, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up on The Frame, inside an exhibit of art made by prisoners. A few years ago, Tatiana von Furstenberg was looking for a simple way to do a good deed every day. And writing a letter to someone in prison came to mind, and she found a pen pal program organized by a group called Black and Pink that advocates for LGBTQ inmates. Von Furstenberg started receiving Black and Pink's newsletter and decided to place an ad in it for art created by inmates. She was soon inundated with submissions, and now a selection of about 100 of those works is in a group show called On the Inside. It's currently at the Kraft Contemporary Museum in Los Angeles. When I stopped by for a tour of the space, von Furstenberg explained more about her call for art.
I did not specify what kind of art I was looking for, and over the next 4 to 5 years, I received 4,000 pieces of art. And they were primarily self-portraits.
How did you start figuring out from those 4,000 pieces what you wanted to present?
I started receiving very slowly. So I would go to the P.O. box and maybe there would be 3 submissions, or then the next month there'd be 5 submissions. And then all of a sudden, I don't know, it must have caught word, but I was receiving 200 a week. It became very, very, very accelerated. And finally, when I had enough of a body that I could see the trends, that's when I started really knowing that it was going to be a show about proclaiming one's identity.
Did you start seeing that pretty early on? Because you were essentially getting a pure random sample. And these are people who are not only physically separated from other inmates, they may be thousands of miles away from the other person who might be drawing something. Did you really start seeing it pretty early on that they were thinking about the same sort of things in terms of what they wanted to present?
What moved me the most, I mean, one thing that they almost all have in common is that on the backs of the art is prison-issued documents. So either rules, regulations, updates, disciplinary forms, and that they would turn that around and use their pencil or their Bic pen, and I hear it's not the entire Bic pen, it's just the inner tube, the soft part, and turn that piece of paper that was intended to further institutionalize them, to turn it around and to make such a fierce and powerful portrait of, you know, their highest identity, not in prison, but in the outfit that they would be wearing if they were not in prison.
There is a lot of folk or outsider art where the artists are not what we would call formally trained. And yet, looking around these walls, there's a degree of execution in a lot of these works that suggests people who have studied years or have a natural gift.
I agree. And yet, having read all of the letters that accompanied the art, many of the artists say that they're self-taught, but the craft and the technique is so refined, the art is so masterful, that I find that incredibly moving as well, because I think even that tells us here on the outside that there's so much talent and emotion and power and strength that we don't have access to because, you know, so many people are incarcerated in this country.
We're talking with Tatiana von Furstenberg about the show On the Inside at Craft Contemporary. I want to ask you about access to materials because there are limits to what they can and cannot use in their drawings. Does that tend to affect the nature of the work, and how creative are some of the inmates in resources to actually create images given that they don't have a lot of material to work with?
So the materials are totally meager. Pencil, Bic pen, some crayon. Then there's a lot of innovation. Like I received one piece that's not in the show, but it was a book and it was bound with powdered milk and water as glue. There's a piece here that's made out of cherry Kool-Aid powder and is an airbrush, and the artist uses their asthma inhaler as the airbrusher.
Let's go take a look at it. I think it's a portrait of Marilyn Monroe. The artist's name is Eric R. Marilyn, and it says airbrushed using Kool-Aid and an asthma inhaler, and it looks like a professional airbrush gun. I mean, the shadowing, the shading.
It really captures Marilyn in all of her glory, the nuances of the shading and the shadow and the way that it is on the page. It's a beautiful piece.
If somebody came in here and there was no labeling, and they walked into this exhibit with zero knowledge, do you think they would be able to determine they were looking at art that was created by inmates and that most of those inmates, if not all, are LGBTQ people?
There have been other shows of quote-unquote prison art, and it was important that I define this show as a group show of LGBTQ artists who are currently incarcerated. The currently incarcerated is at the end because that is the circumstance, not the truest identity of the artist. I think the fact that this collection is that the artists are from the LGBTQ community definitely defines the work. I received a lot of pieces of same-sex couples, a lot of two-spirit pieces, mermaids, fairies, and a lot of like gender-fluid identity pieces. The self-portraits of women themselves, in some cases androgynous, in some cases very proud. So, I mean, there's definitely a strong push in terms of prideful identity and proclaiming that.
I want to ask you about this piece that I was really struck by. It's by an inmate named Lamont W., and the piece is called The Beauty Within Us. And it's a man looking into a mirror, and what he sees reflected back is the image of a woman. But it is really, I think, the way that the artist sees herself, I would imagine, in this picture. And I'm wondering if part of your hope in this show is that people can look at these pictures and imagine what it must be like not only to be an LGBTQ person, but somebody who is institutionalized and start to understand what their lives must feel like.
My most immediate hope is that in this call to art and in the act of drawing, there's an escape. That in drawing, you can forget where you are. I know of one transgender woman who requested that she be put in solitary confinement for the majority of the 12 years that she was behind bars. And that is because she'd already had top surgery, so she already had implants. And so she was very much female presenting, and it was very dangerous for her to be.
Because she was in a men's prison.
Correct. So she felt safer being in solitary confinement. You know, there is no access to identity-affirming anything at all. And not to mention the fact that you're institutionalized with thousands of fellow inmates who are a different gender than you are.
There's an expression that all art is supposed to start some sort of conversation, but you really want this art to start a conversation, and that you put the artist's name, and you have instructions where if you text the name to a certain number, you can become pen pals or have some sort of conversation with the artist. What is your hope in doing that?
What I did not want is for people to come to the museum, come and enjoy the show, and not have any way of giving back. These artists cannot be at their own museum opening. This is huge. The art made it from, you know, prison, from a group of artists who feel completely invisible to their own families, to society, and is now on the walls of a museum. That's a pretty huge thing, and they can't be here to experience it. So I really encourage everybody. I mean, it was not an easy thing to do, but we did develop a computer system. We gave every single piece of art a code. You can go around and text all the artists, and at the end of 2 weeks, we print out all the text. Remember, you don't have a phone behind bars, so these artists don't have their own access to the digital world, but we will print out the text and hard mail it to them. And I think it's the most important part of the show, because the reason that I even began this show is because of how forgotten, marginalized people are.
Tatiana, thanks for having us in.
Thank you so much for your interest.
On the Inside is at the Kraft Contemporary Museum in LA through September 8th. Coming up on The Frame, how the Stonewall Riots led queer musicians around the country to sing out loud and proud about being gay. In the 1960s, queer people were often persecuted and queer spaces were routinely raided by the police. Gay activist Cleve Jones summed it up on the LGBT Q&A podcast in 2017.
Every police department in every major city in this country had special sections whose sole purpose was to hunt down, entrap, arrest, and imprison homosexuals for consenting behavior between adults.
But 50 years ago this week, patrons at the Stonewall Bar in New York City staged a six-day uprising against that police harassment. It galvanized a national movement and transformed queer fear into gay power. And with it came a bold new era of queer music that's been almost lost to history. The Frame's Paul Ratliff has our story.
After Stonewall, queer musicians felt empowered to start openly singing about being queer. When the Stonewall Uprising happened in June of 1969, I was in Missoula, Montana. I heard it on the radio. Homosexuals were rebelling in New York City.
That's Patrick Haggerty. In 1972, his band, Lavender Country, recorded one of the earliest openly queer albums of the era. It's also the first gay country album. For Patrick, news of the Stonewall Rebellion was liberating.
I came out immediately, as soon as I heard the call from Stonewall. I mean, it was like the next day. I went, this is it. This is my call. This is where I make a move.
It don't matter here who you love or what you wear, because we don't care who's got what chromosome.
The Lavender Country record also reflects the radical politics of the gay liberation movement.
The Stonewall Rebellion took place during a radical period in American history. It was connected to the anti-Vietnam War movement, the women's movement. The Black Panthers were very active at this time. Many of us in the Stonewall era were looking for a total transformation of the way society was organized.
Lavender Country, like most queer music of the time, was produced outside the commercial music industry.
When I made Lavender Country, I was not aware of any other gay musician.
What Patrick didn't know is that a group of radical lesbian feminists in Washington, D.C. was about to take the independent production of queer music a step further.
Here come the lesbians, here come the leaping lesbians.
They were about to found one of the most important institutions in the gay music movement of the 1970s, Olivia Records.
She was a big, tough woman, the first to come along, that showed me being female meant you still could be strong.
Founded in 1973, Olivia Records sold millions of albums. The label was run entirely by women, and they made music that spoke directly to the experience of gay women in particular. Their signature work is a record called The Changer and the Changed by Olivia co-founder Chris Williamson. And the song Sweet Woman was a revelation for many gay women who'd never heard their relationships reflected in song. Chris Williamson spoke at last year's Americana Music Association's Honors and Awards show about the impact Sweet Woman had on the women who heard it.
Women told us the most amazing stories. In those days, they wrote letters. Women who wrote to me that when they heard Sweet Woman, women nearly drove off the road because they were weeping so hard, and they had to pull off to the side of the road because they realized it was a song from a woman to a woman.
Meanwhile, 17 members of a men's collective in New England called the Walls to Roses Collective recorded an album to explore the meaning of masculinity. When their album, Walls to Roses, Songs for Changing Men, came out in 1979, it contained a song that would become an anthem in the gay liberation movement, a song called Gay Spirit by Charlie Murphy.
There's a gay spirit singing in our hearts, leading us through these troubled times.
Walls to Roses was conceived with an emphasis on inclusion. The collective hired female musicians, engineers, and even photographers to make the record, and it also featured a pioneering Black gay singer-songwriter with the gender-neutral name Blackberry.
We choose to love each other only openly gay.
The album closes with a Blackberry song that stresses the importance of what we would now call intersectionality.
A lot of my music is about coalition building. My song on Walls of Roses was about racism, gay rights, and ERA. The song basically says, we've got to win together for things to get better. Me, you know, we're not going to do this by ourselves. We have to support each other's struggles. That's what I've always preached, I guess you could say.
We lost in Eugene.
When will the ignorance?
When will humankind learn to be friends?
Blackberry and Patrick Haggerty from Lavender Country have been friends for more than four decades. The music they each made outside of the mainstream recording industry, along with albums from Olivia Records and others, gave a nation of queer people a soundtrack to their lives and to their activism. Haggerty had this to say about the network of queer musicians that formed during the gay liberation era.
I've been iconized a lot, turned into some kind of something that I'm not. And I'm reflecting then and now, if you were being public about being gay during those years, whether anybody called you that or not, all of us were icons.
For The Frame, I'm Paul Ratliff.
And that's it for The Frame today. I'm John Horn in the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. We'll be back here tomorrow.